Blog Talk Radio.
Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson, and I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Andre Rodatis and Crystalyn B. Larson. Good morning, you guys.
Good morning,
Paula. Good morning, Crystalyn.
How
are
you doing?
It is morning where we are. Yeah, great. We were all three at a wonderful Christmas party last night at the home of our dear friends, more dear friends, Mo Siegel and Jennifer Siegel in Boulder, and it's always a great, it's the social event of the Boulder Urantia community every year. Everybody looks forward to it. It's a big deal, and I took a lot of pictures. I'm going to post them on Facebook later because everyone has such a wonderful time. Jennifer's an amazing cook, and she made a fabulous meal for us all, and we sing Christmas carols, and even though the Urantia book teaches us that Jesus wasn't born on the 25th of December, that is the Mithraic holiday, and it was a compromise with some of the pagan religions and to go ahead and make that the celebration, it's still high holy days for Christianity all over the world, and the spirit is there. And I'm quite certain that our precious Lord doesn't care. If we chose to celebrate his life every day of the year, he'd probably be fine with that.
Yeah.
And
what did Mo say yesterday? 2.5 billion people celebrating at this
right. At
this season and thinking of the beginning of the Master's life.
And holding them
yeah.
in their hearts, you know.
Yeah.
And I get deep and sensitive at this time of year. It's a very special time for me because I just have loved Jesus all my life. And I always got the meaning of Christmas. It was never a matter, you know, of not getting the purpose and meaning of Christmas. And I think when people complain about materialism and all, then I get it. You know, it's over the top, you know. But by the same token, I just think that we choose a day, his birthday, to give each other gifts and delight in that, or to spread the cheer around the world. We get deep and sensitive at this time, and it's you feel that spirit. So in that spirit, we've decided to do three shows, and we've been building up to this one. And this week, it is Jesus, what is meant by the kingdom of heaven? And it's a term that he used a lot, and certainly key to his teachings. And we've asked, in the previous 2 weeks, we've asked what was the purpose of Jesus' life, why did he come here, and now we're on to the kingdom. What did he mean by the term the kingdom of heaven? And Andre wrote our blurb for us this week, and he chose some great quotes. So we're going to start with those. But I think we have our two guests on too. We're expecting Angie Thurston. Angie's been on before. She's a repeat guest. She lives in New York. She's attending a divinity school at Harvard. And Jonathan Zoba, a natural organic farmer. I'm going to actually let them tell you more about themselves, though, because they know a lot more about themselves than I know. Are you guys with us?
Yeah.
Angie and Jonathan?
We are.
Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to hear you.
I'm so glad you guys came on. You know, Jonathan, I was thinking about it. You know, I really don't know a whole lot about you, and I'd love to know more about you. So do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. I live in Maine, and I live and work on a bean farm.
On a bean farm?
Kidney beans, for example.
Oh, wonderful.
Jonathan, we're getting a little reverb from you. If you guys have your have the radio program on, make sure you mute it or turn it off in the background. That might help. Otherwise, we may have to have you call back in.
Oh, okay. Is that any better?
It sounds better.
Yeah, I don't have the program on, but I was standing near Angie. Maybe it's like picking up over both of our phones.
Ah, yes.
That's probably what's happening.
So how did you find the Urantia book, Jonathan? Or do you go by John, by the way?
Yeah, either one.
Both?
You know,
okay.
Jonathan is my full name.
Okay.
But, yeah, you know, it was, I was in college, and I guess it was like 11 years ago. My buddy read about it online and told me about it. And, you know, in college you're supposed to be oriented to learning new things, so... Yeah, checked it out and definitely clicked.
Yay.
Well,
and welcome to
the
show. Glad to have
you
back.
You had grown up in a fairly strong Christian community prior to that as well. Maybe you can share a little bit about that.
I guess I kind of think of it in some ways comparable to how the Jewish community is described in the first century in the Urantia book. You know, we grew up with other kids, you know, learning all the normal things kids learn, but also we were pretty deeply steeped in study of the Bible and, you know, the church. And it was a pretty strong, close-knit community, which to some extent I'm still a part of, and both my parents were ordained ministers, and so, yeah, I ended up going to a Christian college, which is where I found the book, and it was kind of like the, I don't know, the fulfillment of my religion, you know, of what I consider to be a true Christian, you know, will hear the voice of the master when he speaks.
There you go.
Voice of the shepherd. And he has spoken through the book.
Mm. Boy, I resonate with that. I actually do hear his voice in my heart of hearts when I read any words that are supposedly from him. You know, if it's his words, then I hear his voice in my heart. It's really quite an experience, but it's validating too, you know. And there's a personality, a wisdom that comes through that's just so unsurpassed and so characteristic of him that you can't, you know, not recognize it if you love him.
Yeah, and that voice can continue to speak through us.
you know, if yeah. it's in our heart, then, you know, through the lives that we live, then, you know, others can be drawn to the Master too.
True.
So explain that again, Jonathan. A number of our listeners might have heard, okay, so you found the Urantia book in a Christian college. Well, I'm curious about the details around that. How did that actually come about? Because some people might think that it would have been inimical to your finding the Urantia book being in a Christian college.
Well, you know, I was definitely a weirdo. I was really, really into crop circles and kind of figuring out what was going on with that, and that kind of led to interest in aliens. And I don't know, I just wanted to figure out what was going on, and I had liberated myself from biblical authoritarianism, as had a couple of my peers. But yeah, we were definitely fringe culturally. And, you know, with the internet, it's like, if you seek, you will find. You know, it's like it kind of trumps any sort of cultural limitation in any context. You know, like, yeah, we were on campus at a Christian college, but, you know, with the internet, you can find anything. And so my buddy, who I was kind of exploring all this stuff with, he got real trigger happy with Amazon, started ordering tons of weird books, and at one point it was like, people who read this book also read this book, and the Urantia book came up, and so he ordered it along with a bunch of other books. Actually, he was kind of leaning more towards Satanism. He got real into Satanism.
Mm.
And along with it all came the Urantia book, and I nabbed that from his dorm room and started reading the Jesus papers. And, you know, he ended up kind of, you know, he got into some bad stuff. It was really the wrong direction, but the Urantia book came along with it, and then he ended up burning all of his books that he ordered, including the Urantia book,
oh.
and, like, kind of reconverting back to, conservative Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. I've heard of that before.
Me too.
I've heard of people doing that, yeah. It's a fear reaction more than anything else, yeah.
It's what makes sense, you know. It's a foundation, and it makes sense. And, you know, I guess if you go too far afield, then, you know, you just feel like you have to get back to your root. And,
yeah, I mean, he was definitely going down the wrong path, you know, no question about it, intellectually.
Yeah.
It's a shame that he kind of included the Urantia book and all that other nonsense that he was into, but, you know, in time, things have sifted. We're still friends, and he's kind of grown to see that the Urantia book is definitely not Satanism.
Mm-hmm.
No, definitely not. Most definitely not, you know.
Well, sadly, a lot of people are afraid of something that claims to be a new revelation, that's for sure.
Well, yeah.
Well,
that's
yeah.
nothing new.
There's a lot of false teachers claiming to have new revelations. You know, that's
there
definitely a real thing.
It is. And I have come to believe that a true spiritual teaching will uplift you. It empowers you as an individual. A false teaching enslaves you to some,
yeah.
to the teacher, typically to the teacher. You have to become subservient to the teacher, and it's what it's all about. Look at me, look to me, I'm the one, I'll give you what you need, you know, or whatever, I'll tell you what God's thinking, or I'll tell you what the voices are saying, or, you know, whereas a true spiritual teaching just gives you knowledge for its own sake and tells you to look to God. The power's in you, and it empowers you. And of course, from having spent so much time with the Urantia book, because I found it when I was 20, it really gave me a sense of how to see the difference between You know, because that's what it does. It empowers the individual. It empowers you to live a courageous and faithful life. And, you know, it empowers you to study what you have to study and recognize the truth in wherever you can find it.
Yeah,
but
and beyond, beyond
that,
that
God alone.
It manifests in service. You know,
right.
It's like it almost kind of, it empowers you to the extent that the moment it empowers you, you're empowering somebody else.
Right.
You know, by serving them. You know, it that's what I like about it. It kind of removes the you from the equation. Angie and I were just doing our homework, reading the Kingdom of Heaven paper, and they're talking about to the extent that you can receive and experience God's forgiveness is to the extent that you forgive your fellows. And so it's, you know, this active, kind of actual, real, practical thing that links you to other people in, you know, healthy and social ways.
And self-forgetful ways, unselfish ways. I mean, that's clearly a cornerstone of the teachings, the Urantia teachings, is unselfish service and loving service.
They say something like, you know, if the act is to be judged by the motive, then, you know, the greatest good done is always unconscious, because you're, the only thing you're thinking about is others, you know, the actual needs of your neighbor and your capacity to, you know, to serve them doesn't require ever thinking about yourself, or only thinking about yourself to the extent that it's helpful in serving someone else.
Right. Well, and Angie, we've had you on the show. Actually, we've had Jonathan on the show before, too. But Angie's been on several times, Angie Thurston. And Angie, by distinction, you grew up with the Urantia book. You and Crystalline have that in common. Me and Andre and Jonathan, we found it. But you guys grew up with it, which is a whole different
experience. All of you found it when you were very young. So you have that in common.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
But it's great to have you too, Angie. We're still getting just a bit of a reverb when Jonathan speaks. There's a little bit of an echo, but hopefully it's not too bothersome. I don't know. You might. Crystalline told me you may want to go into separate rooms.
We are.
That sounds kind of funny.
We
to
did.
Say
yeah.
That. Oh, you did. Okay.
Okay.
You two go into separate rooms now. But so you guys were doing your homework on the Kingdom of Heaven, and there's so much, like I said, Jesus in the Jesus papers about the Kingdom of Heaven, and it's mentioned throughout the book. And Andre threw out an opening salvo here, which I really like this quote that you chose, Andre, for the blurb. You said, Jesus did not propose to meddle with the affairs of earthly rule, that he was only concerned with the establishment of the spiritual brotherhood of believers, which brotherhood he called the Kingdom of Heaven. And we know from having read the story of Jesus and having read the Urantia book that Jesus was having a hard time communicating what he preferred, and his preference was the heavenly, the family, the idea of the family. He desired it, because a little further down, Andre gives us this quote: Jesus desired to substitute for the idea of the kingdom, king, and subjects, the concept of the heavenly family, the heavenly Father, and the liberated sons of God engaged in joyful and voluntary service for their fellow men and in the sublime and intelligent worship of God the Father. And I love that quote, Andre. That is just like, you know, so right before the show, Andre and I were talking about this central issue that he had And that is, and we know that the family, the nuclear family, mother, father, children, the family is the cornerstone of civilization. It is the building block, the basic building block. And a civilization is only as good as the families are, the families that make it up, and only as strong and secure and viable. And so I'm going to throw out this first question to you guys, and that is, you know, do you think that part of the problem, because we know that the Jews of Jesus' day really had a good, strong family life, but even so, Jesus had a hard time sharing this concept of a cosmic family with the father of which family was God. He really had, that was the concept he wanted to share, but he had to revert to the idea of the kingdom. And we're still having that, you know, concept of the kingdom. We still commonly refer to it. So how can we go about, or, you know, promoting this idea of a loving cosmic family, true brotherhood and sisterhood in mankind?
Well, one thing that struck me in reading this paper again, and in Jesus's effort to replace the term kingdom of God, is that in addition to the family idea, he wanted to replace kingdom with will, the will of God, and that's a very practical term and a very active one. And that was something that I kind of re-realized in considering the idea of the kingdom of heaven and the way that it's evolved, is that in terms of something that we might be able to do in order to be part of that clarifying effort that Jesus undertook so long ago, would be to focus on the activeness of what it is to enter the kingdom, and that takes place in every moment, that it is a present and lived experience, and that it's really just predicated on two things, the first being faith and the second being hunger and thirst for righteousness. And that is something that we enact, as John was saying, through loving service to our fellows. So in that act, as we live it each day, we become more and more a manifestation of a family and of the family of God on this planet. So whether we can conceptually replace it, I don't know, but through our actions, we can certainly live it and thereby over time, I think, come to embody a family more than a kingdom.
Well, I think, as Jonathan said too, it's going to be sort of an unconscious process. Then there's something that we can do to strengthen our spiritual habit patterns so that our service is unconscious, it is automatic. And that part of it can be conscious. You know, we practice reacting in a spiritually savory way on a daily basis.
Yeah, I like the fact that Angie, you know, related this back to the will of God. And I'm very grateful, forever grateful to the Urantia book for not giving a cookie-cutter definition or anything, but giving a very, very simple definition of the will of God that isn't dogmatic, but that actually allows us to see that, as opposed to it being something hard and elusive and you can't find it and it's really hard to do, It defines it simply as the doing of the will of God is nothing more or less than an exhibition of creature willingness to share the inner life with God, with the very God who has made such a creature life of inner meaning value possible, sharing as godlike, divine. So the fact that we've been given that kind of simple definition makes it easier to transfer from ideas like the kingdom of heaven to the family of God by virtue of seeing that all that God really wants is for us to be one big happy family. and to do that, we have to acknowledge him and acknowledge each other as family members. So I know I interrupted you, Jonathan. I want to hear what you had to say, but I wanted to... it seems to me that isn't that simple? Are we closer to understanding that today? Do you think we can get to the place of getting more and more people to realize just how simple it is to do the will of God?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the implication of the family concept is to realize that, you know, nothing happens in a vacuum. How you treat somebody else is, in a way, is, you know, related to how you're treating yourself. If you, you know, properly understand the family and that, like, we share a common origin and potentially a common destiny. And, like, you know, like you're quoting about sharing the inner life, it's like all of reality to begin with is an act of sharing. You know, the I am diversified himself in such a way that he could share himself in as many possible manifestations as, you know, finitude is willing to experience. And, you know, that's the origin in reality of our situation. And, you know, the illusion is that, you know, we're isolated, that we have to, you know, exist for ourselves. And so it's like, you know, when you kind of see that, in a sense, you know, we're all in one household, it just becomes the most rational thing, the most reasonable thing, to want to go out of your way to, you know, help your neighbor or help a stranger or whatever, because, you know, that's the most reasonable thing to do, you know, given the reality of the fact of our existence. And so, like, yeah, in that way, it's like, yeah, it can remove the sense of, like, self from, you know, I'm doing this because this is my good deed or whatever, to, you know, this is my brother, and, you know, it brings me pleasure to help him out, you know, because the fact that I'm even alive is because a brother has helped me out, or really a father has created me and provided for me. So what other reasonable way is there to act than to, you know, than to continue to share the blessings that have already been shared with us by our Heavenly Father?
Absolutely.
It is a process, too. You know, it seems to me that we kind of grow in that understanding, and it sinks to deeper levels of our consciousness. And I find it interesting, the term the kingdom of heaven is interesting to me, because obviously kingdoms are a thing of the past. They weren't in Jesus' day, and I can see how that term was useful to him in as much as, you know, there were kingdoms, and there were kind and good, benevolent kings who treated their subjects well and whose subjects lived in harmony together. And so, you know, to say the kingdom of heaven then is this place, not of this world, but of another world, a heavenly realm, that kingdom presided over by a kind and loving and benevolent king, our Father God. And this king is so just and so fair and so loving. He would never ask anything of any of us that would, you know, wouldn't be ultimately in our best interest. And he had to build on that concept because this idea that he is our Father, even the concept of spirit, to me, here's where people really get stuck, you know, and where they stumble as to whether or not God is real or God even exists, say. They don't really have a good concept of spirit and what that means and what that is. And the Urantia book gives us such a sublime concept of that from the very beginning. And one of the first things it says is that we have conceptual poverty. And I was thinking about that this morning as I was waking up, you know, trying to get my head ready for the show today. Thinking about, you know, because the kingdom of heaven really is an example of a little bit of conceptual poverty on our part. And much of that is due to the fact that we've been robbed over the course of our evolution as a human race of many of those foundational concepts that would have helped us grasp other greater and deeper meanings as we went forward. And that certainly comes from, you know, the default and the rebellion, but also the fact that we're in isolation. And so we're kind of like the, you know, in a way, like the jungle boy, you know, who...
raised by wolves.
Yeah. Doesn't have the social concepts of the greater civilization, and the greater civilization being all of the inhabited worlds. And it's very interesting to me. I mean, I find it intriguing when people don't even believe that there are other inhabited worlds. You know, because I was beginning to come to terms with that when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
When I was 10 years old, I reached out with my heart and my mind and said, I know there's life out there. I know that there's life on other planets. And I'm willing to bet that it's probably good, even better than us, not just all monsters, you know, scary monsters on every planet in space.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know... So this, but
not everybody is trying to kill everybody else,
right? Because that's our so our conceptual poverty comes from our isolation, I think, to a large degree, and we have to figure these things out. And
yeah,
go ahead.
Not just our isolation, but because of deliberate deception on the part
yes.
of the evil
Ooh,
one. I mean, there is a conceptual war going on. That has been going on from the beginning, you know, and you know the great pretender, the perverter, you know, it's like it's not
the
an accident that we're so confused about things. It's you know that there is a Lanamindex on that has been actively trying to confuse and distort things in our minds for a really long time,
and he's thwarted every effort that has been made by the universe to give us...
Well,
he's attempted to, at least.
Yeah, he's attempted to, yeah.
If you think about the fact that we don't really know where other planets that fell into the rebellion, we don't really know where they were along the lines of their own evolutionary status when that happened. But for us, it happened right at the beginning. Right at the dawn of civilization. So when you think about how long this planet has been steeped in that deception and how much it permeates all of our culture, it's really quite profound that we even have a religious urge at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's a testament power of thought of the coming of the thought adjusters that we have such a strong religious fervor, even when it's confused or backwards or upside down. It's really quite amazing that it's there at all.
And we've talked many times on the show when we did the series on the Master Seraphim, all the changes that Jesus initiated when he came here. And I think I've shared that quote about, you know, he said, I've come to make a beginning of setting these things right. But many ages will be required to restore this part of the universe to former paths. And, you know, I love that because it gives me a perspective. Nothing's going to change overnight. But when you think about how long we kind of plodded on in darkness, and then this amazing life touched this world, and this carpenter from Nazareth, this humble, beautiful, amazing being. If ever, I like to tell people, if ever there was an ambassador from the heavenly realms, he's it. We don't set our clocks to the birth of Buddha, you know, date our calendars to. There's been many wonderful, good, as Jesus said, my Father has given you many prophets. But of all of them, the impact that one life had on this world is astonishing. And then when you dig deeper, you find that the things that he set up after he left, the spirit of truth that was poured out, universal thought adjusters, those master seraphim, the council of 24, all of those things he enacted to get the ball rolling, to set us right and to get us going. And, you know, I didn't finish the concept that I was trying to get at was this idea of spirit, how, you know, we have to believe that we are spirit beings. We have to believe that there is more to us than just this flesh and bone and just this one life. And sometimes, you know, when I'm talking to people who are heading down the atheist or agnostic path, I tell them, look, you know, I just refuse to believe that I was born into this world and I learned all of these lessons. I learned to walk and talk and read and communicate and, you know, and love and give and serve. And my education and my achievements, my children, the things that I've achieved in life that I'm proud of, that give me satisfaction and effort, and the lessons I've learned about altruism and brotherhood and kindness and loyalty, honesty, all of those things just die when I do, and it's all for naught. Everything I gain, everything I've achieved is just, well, poof, gone. You know, I mean, it's kind of shallow to say, well, no, you know, because they'll say, well, it goes on, you know, because you'll be, you know, in 100 years, nobody will remember that I was here. And so, you know, for me, that God is the author of my being. I understand I have a Father, that there is more to me than flesh and bone. I have an eternal aspect to my beingness, and I've always felt that. And I'm sure you guys would agree, because you've probably felt that too. I know that about all of you. You felt an eternal aspect to yourself, and that is so key to this concept of the family of God and the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of men. That's it. You have to embrace God as a father, the author of your being, to understand that then all human beings have that same author.
Yeah,
but
that's go ahead.
No, go ahead, Andre.
Well, I you making all those points has just been bringing to mind to me, you know, how far we have yet to go in getting much of the world to be able to get, on the one hand, just even to the idea of a kingdom of heaven, let alone the family of God, when mm-hmm. when so much of formal religion still emphasizes this this relationship with God, which is so fear-ridden, so subservient, so dogmatically rule-encumbered, Not that inner rules are not important, but there's so much dogma that is there to serve ecclesiastical authority more than it is to serve the individual in their spiritual growth, that you wonder how we're going to get from just even the state of the world today to embracing ideas like the kingdom of heaven, or let alone the family of God. But it brings to mind another aspect of this for me, and that is that the kingdom of heaven was popular in the minds, 2,000 years ago, because somehow there was this need for power to be the important organizing principle. People wanted to see the powers that be overthrown. They wanted to see a new order come about. And we still have a lot of that kind of thinking today. Mm-hmm. The family of God has a decided love emphasis, and Jesus was masterful in trying to use the kingdom of heaven idea in imbuing that with the idea of a benevolent father who was dominated by love, who would only use that power for love, so that the power became completely subordinate to the love of God. So I'm thinking of that, and as I'm thinking of that, I'm thinking of the fact that Angie is at Harvard Divinity School and by now knows the composition of her classes very well and the kinds of fellow students she has. And I'm curious as to how do you see us evolving to concepts of God that go away from the power and the fear of God kinds of ideas that we have to the love of God? How do we get what kinds of things do you see as barriers to where we need to go, and what do you see as new developments which may actually assist in the evolution of this concept?
All right. If I talk, is there any reverberation or feedback?
You're fine.
No.
Okay. Well, part of what led me to school, and I think I've shared this on the show, is finding that my peers were turning away from organized religion, and that's a big trend. And, when that happens, there's a whole range of different forms that it might take in somebody's life, and sometimes that means engaging in spiritual practices and conceiving of daily experiences as having spirit value, and sometimes it doesn't. But one thing that I've noticed consistently is that there's some confusion about the relationship between ethics and religion, in some ways people they can be comfortable with concepts of morality and social ethics, even if they have turned away from a structure of organized religion. And yet I think the mistake that is being made is to conceive of that ethic as actually being the substance of religion. And what's very clarifying about the presentation of the kingdom of heaven in the Urantia book is the idea that religion is personal and individual, and that it's the fruits of that experience which yield ethics. And I think that that is the seed of what could be helpful, at least in the environment I find myself in, as far as trying to clarify a little bit and move toward a possible understanding of religion as a personal experience, and that the various organized components of it that exist could certainly be, what do they say, the riverbed is not the river, but,
exactly.
Talk about the value that those organizations can have in fostering the fruits of the Spirit on a, you know, on a larger scale. And I think that can still certainly be the case. And in fact, part of what I've been learning is that for people who are saying things like, I'm spiritual but not religious, in practice, a lot of those people are really neither. Because what encourages a conception of daily life as spiritual comes from the fraternal experience of being in organized religious settings, or at least settings where spiritual language is being used and where opportunities for fellowship and service-oriented interaction are provided. So, you know, we certainly need our family. You know, as John said, it doesn't happen in a vacuum. Spirituality can't happen in a vacuum. And so there's, I think, a pretty big transition happening. And we're very much, I think, still in the beginning of it in many ways, just this sort of move that's happening away from organized religion has not yet been filled in with something that would be fruitful. And so there's the more that I'm here, the more I am amazed by the revelation that we have and the appropriateness of it for the time in which we're living.
Mm-hmm.
The wisdom of it. Well, we little station identification here. You're listening to The Cosmic Citizen on Blog Talk Radio, and we're talking about what is meant by the Kingdom of Heaven. And we have another caller, you guys, I'd like to put on. They've been waiting for a while. Area code 520, you're with us on The Cosmic Citizen.
Hi, guys.
Hi. Who's this?
Hi. Aaron.
Oh,
we
hi, Aaron.
Aaron. Yeah. Hi, from last week. Hi.
Welcome back.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been listening to the conversation. It's quite good.
Did you want to add something?
Well, yeah, of course.
Of course.
Yeah. Well, we're talking about the concepts of the Kingdom of Heaven, and really, you had through your talk, you went over a lot of the reasons why we're where we're at, and that's because we're an isolated planet. Like you said, a child that maybe is born with wolves, we were born into a world that has never had supervisors available to teach us about God in the direct fashion that any normal world would have. So here we are, grown up over thousands and thousands of years, isolated, just thinking to ourselves, well, we're the only ones here, in those who aren't touched by religion in their daily lives. And that's the other side of it. We have this this evolutionary mix with revelatory religion that's turned into myths and legends and all the mixture that goes on a world that is isolated, to leave us in this position where a kingdom of heaven that Jesus was speaking about isn't anywhere near where we could be at this time. I mean, we're on one side of the planet smashing atoms and still dancing around the fire with a rattle in our hand on the other side of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So that leaves
sometimes on the same side of the planet.
Sometimes on the
same
side.
Of the planet. Right. So what do we got to do to get all the to get to this era of light and life, or to even just to get to where we can love one another on a regular basis? Well, we know we've got that answer. It's the book. We got to get the book out. And I'm going to be the guy that, if I ever come on here again, that's all I'm going to say, get the book out. Because how did we come to where we're at? We came to it through the book. We came to it by understanding Jesus and learning that we had an indwelling spirit. And we're eons ahead of most people around us. I was talking with a cousin last night who have come to visit us. They're down in Tucson, Arizona with their motorhome, you know, driving around. And they're retired. She's 71 years old. And she said, what's that book on the table? I said, well, that's your Christmas present. She said, "What is it?" I said, "I got to ask you, are you a truth seeker?" "I've been searching all my life." Well, that started the conversation off. But I'm speaking from the level of a 35-year reader that's read the book probably 21 to 22 times, and I'm talking to her about universes and God and our place in the cosmos, and she's, "So what's it say?" You know, and we've got to remember, we're eons ahead of everyone else around us because we found this book. Well, how many are out there? Maybe 750,000 books, maybe close to a million now, I don't know. But how many actual solid readers do we know of? Maybe 5,000, 10,000, maybe 20,000? But how many are living these truths? If there were only 20,000 people in the world of 7 billion, we've got a long way to go. We've got to get these books.
Well, but there also, though, on the same vein, I mean, and not to disagree with you, because I do agree, there are still many who are growing spiritually, who do understand the concept of the kingdom of heaven through their own personal relationship with God, because thankfully there are many, there still are many streams that do promote a God concept in the world. And like myself and Jonathan, who grew up within Christian communities where there were many people who were, there are many families who were teaching those principles, I don't think we can assume that the book is the only resource out there to getting to that concept.
No. Well, that's from the teachings of our apostles who took what Jesus had taught them for 4 years, and then even that twisted and misinformed gospel is what we have that we're working with now. Yes, and it's spread and went over 2,000 years it took to get to be 3.5 billion people that believe in it in some form or shape.
So well, you know, going back to something Jonathan said, you know, there's a great quote in the Urantia book about being a better righteousness recommender this year than you were last year. And here it is right here. It's from paper 156. And this is how I think, you know, because it, and I want to follow up with a short poem after this quote, because it's how clever are we at leavening the dough? How clever are we at putting truth in the place of error? And, you know, because we really have to get good at that so that people, we get them to think about these concepts in an earnest way, and in a logical way. And here's the quote. It's from paper 156, which is Jesus' sojourn at Tyre and Sidon. As the days pass, every true believer becomes more skillful in alluring his fellows into the love of eternal truth. Are you more resourceful in revealing goodness to humanity today than you were yesterday? Are you a better righteousness recommender this year than you were last year? Are you becoming increasingly artistic in your technique of leading hungry souls into the spiritual kingdom? And the poem that I want to share is one that I think embodies a tremendous artistic ability to do, you know, to do that very thing. And it's by Vern Grimsley, and I know you guys have all heard it, but it's one of my very favorites. He says, "All humankind is one vast family. This world, our home. We sleep beneath one roof, the starry sky. We warm ourselves before one hearth, the blazing sun. Upon one floor of soil we stand and breathe one air and drink one water and walk the night beneath one luminescent moon. The children of one God we are, and brothers of one blood, and members in one worldwide family of God.
Yeah, that's just wonderful.
What a beautiful artistic way of describing the family of God.
Yeah, and I think kind of related to what Angie was mentioning earlier with like the spiritual but not religious thing is, is just the idea of the father concept, you know, that we all have one father. And like until that's recognized by people, it you know, it doesn't matter like what spiritual or meditative practices, you know, or anything we do, because it's not, you know, it's not oriented to any sort of direction. It's just oriented to the self. And I think, like, the father concept, you know, speaking of, like, conceptual poverty, in some ways I think, like, the conceptual war is, like, most intensely concentrated on the father concept.
Mm.
You see...
Good point.
Yeah,
I mean, you see all, you know, all over culture and media, like, kind of debate or criticism or denial of the father concept. You know, often fathers are
Or even making fun of it, almost.
Yeah. A lot of times men or fathers are represented as being, like, stupid or, you know, doofuses. Or,
doofuses,
you know, or worse.
I've noticed that.
You know, abusive. And so there's kind of this, it's like in vogue to be, you know, kind of anti-father. And so then with that kind of comes this, like, everybody kind of straying into all these, like, different directions, and there's no, you know, there's no coordinating principle in the direction we're all going. And you know, naturally this goes back to, you know, our planetary origins of the father of our planet, you know, did abuse us, basically, and he denied our true father. And Jesus, you know, saw that as being the biggest problem, basically, on this planet, that, you know, the conceptual poverty regarding the father. And so he, you know, he committed his entire life to upholding and glorifying this father concept, you know, a whole life in the flesh. And so it's like now, you know, if there's any confusion about what the father concept truly means, now we can look to Jesus, and, you know, as the life that he lived. And you know, fundamentally, that's like, you know, no matter how many times we've read the Urantia book or whatever, it's like if Jesus, who knew way more than any Urantia book reader could know, you know, simply focused on upholding the father concept in this world, then to me it seems pretty clear that, you know, similarly, I think the part of the core of our mission is to uphold the father concept in our own lives and to articulate it, you know, to whatever extent we are capable, you know, of people's understanding. And I think this is all kind of related to the idea of the kingdom of heaven and the trouble that Jesus had teaching it, in that he wanted us to understand it more as a family, you know, the family of heaven. But, you know, people couldn't get over the idea of king, because, and it goes back to this war on the father concept,
are the king of this, or our planetary father, like, really, you know, he betrayed us. And so then we kind of had to revert to depending on, like, authoritative kings to, like, defend us or fight or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the idea of a loving father concept became removed from people's minds for so many thousands of years that, you know, salvation can only come from a king, you know, who can overthrow a tyrant. And in some ways, I think that's kind of related, you know, to the contemporary problem, too. You know, like Angie was talking about, a lot of people are just into ethics, you know, or social justice, mm-hmm. or whatever. And that's, mm-hmm. like, conceptually kind of going on the same path of, like, you know, kingdomness. It's like sidestepping the core familial fatherly concept of how we go about changing the world, and it kind of focuses on the kingdom aspect. And so, yeah, all this to say, I think, like, fundamentally it comes back to the simple, you know, father concept as, you know, that kind of being the nucleus of our mission and message to the world.
So, Jonathan, I'd like to marry that concept with Angie's concept of you know, how do we get to this idea of more and more people practicing in their lives what we know in the Arantia book is referred to as personal religion, which, when you really study it, aside from, you know, some other usages, a few other usages, religion is always meant in that personal way. Nothing else is really referred to as religion other than that personal, spiritual, loving relationship that we have with God. How do we get people? They're not going to get to a real living concept of God unless they have that personal relationship. And I was really struck with what Angie was saying, in that without some kind of fellowship, fraternity, sorority, you know, all together, if you don't have contact with your fellows, you don't have some of the service possibility, and you don't have the chance for bolstering each other's personal spiritual practice. We don't practice in isolation. If you're in a centering prayer group, for example, it helps to bolster your own personal practice that is leading you into making sure you have that personal relationship with God. So how do you see that coming about? I might throw this to Angie first, and Jonathan and Aaron, I'm interested in your ideas on this too.
Well, you're certainly asking the same questions that I'm asking, Andre. And at this point, you know, so much of my experience at school so far has just been one of discovery and of coming to the kinds of realizations that you just described. But I certainly have to agree with John, first of all, about the fundamental importance of the father idea and of the possibility of personal relationship, even. I think something that has also become very apparent to me in terms of conceptual poverty is our lack of understanding about personality and the importance of that, that is woven through Jesus's teachings and through the teachings of the Urantia book as being really fundamental to any basis for having a personal relationship with God. Must be one in which you acknowledge the existence of personality, the uniqueness of personality, and the latent potential there for relationship. So, you know, starting from that premise that so much of existence is at its core relationship, and specifically loving relationship, as much as I definitely cannot presume to know the answer to the question that you asked, Andre, I definitely see the possibilities that would come about just by increased understanding of the value of personal relationships, particularly familial relationships. And that's, again, I mean, as relates to the father concept, I think something that it's hard to say what will come first, but as we uplift the idea of the father and the ideal of the father, both in our human lives and the father concept of God, there is just so much that shifts about all of the social outworkings of our, you know, whether they're religious or secular. And I feel like each of us with our unique personalities can contribute something to that undertaking. And the specifics of what I'm going to try to contribute, I have yet to determine. But one thing that the book makes clear is that, you know, community as such is something that grows organically, you know, so the idea of trying to impose it or create it is not really one that I would feel comfortable undertaking. So that's why a lot of what I've been trying to do here in the Boston area is just get an understanding for the communities that exist already and to understand what it would mean to be a part of the communities here and, you know, within that to live each day, you know, both in further development of my own personal relationship with God and then to understand what it would mean to serve the individuals that I encounter. And I think a really amazing example of this was just this morning because John and I went to go read the Urantia book at the coffee shop around the corner, and lo and behold, sitting right next to us was somebody else who had the Urantia book open on the table.
No kidding.
No way.
Yeah. And he was another young guy about our age, I would say, and he was reading it through for the first time, and he was, I would say, maybe a third of the way through. So we ended up reading together, you know.
Wow.
Just creating, you know, by the intention that we had to come participate on this show today, which is the result of, you know, the actualizing of the intention that you guys had to create this show. You know, it's like each of these decisions preface another opportunity and another chance to make a decision that is going to yield the following fruit, you know. So
that's pretty cool, though. That's a pretty cool story because that isn't something that just happens every day.
Yeah,
no,
it's
not.
I think, like, yeah, it's just part of it is just physically being together in the same space. You know, like if the family concept is going to be real, like first the family has to have a context of functioning as a family, and the only way that can happen is for us to, you know, live close to one another, side by side. And you know, I don't necessarily mean just us Urantia book readers, but just people in general to be purposeful about, you know, sharing a physical space and sharing resources and, you know, and cooperating and, you know, in the very physical and real struggle, you know, that we all have just existing. And that's kind of the spirit of this weekend was, you know, Angie and I had been communicating a lot over the phone about, you know, this upcoming conference and stuff and email, and it was just like, well, we just got to be together in person. And and so I came down, and it just sets something in motion when you're physically together, and you know, possibilities come about that, you know, never could have been expected, as was exemplified by this morning, us two physically being together, deciding to go into public to read the Urantia book, And sure enough, in that physical space, you know, not like a chat room or a conceptual this or that, we were just in close physical proximity to other people, and that connection was made. And you see it in Jesus' life, you know, he had these profound concepts that he was teaching, and he was the master at teaching them, but he lived so intimately with everyone in his life, so closely, you know, living and working together, traveling together, you know, physically sharing things together. He
breaking
was just so,
bread together.
Yeah.
Yeah. And watching for opportunities, being open to that fabric, you know, that we're all moving in a field together. We're all in this same spiritual field. And that is, of course, our mother. She holds the space, and her angels do the work. And so, you know, to bring those personalities together, and I just like to think they got a cosmic chuckle out of the two of you going down to the coffee shop, and the joy that you felt when you saw that fellow also reading the book, and to be
well,
able
and
to
the way
there
it
together.
Gives, and the way that, like you say, Angie and Jonathan, that you make the intention and then you act on it, and you you physically are together, and then all of a sudden it makes it, it opens up the opportunity for the seraphim to engage in social architecture.
Mm-hmm.
And
exactly.
there really is nothing that takes the place of being together face-to-face in the same space. And worshiping or studying together is a multiplication of resources for everyone who's there. You know, it's more than just the sum of the parts. You get this expanded experience that when you're looking for it and when you're aware of it, when you understand that personality dynamic, you appreciate it, and then you want more of it, and you want other people to be able to experience the same kind of thing.
You know, that makes me think that in a loving family, and this whole conversation has really brought to mind for me the difference between institutionalized religion and socialized religion, and there's a great couple of paragraphs in the book about that. And Angie, your comments especially brought that to me, and I was just thinking about how in a healthy family dynamic, when the children, you know, the parents may help the children and guide the children to find, you know, pick their heroes carefully and find their life's work carefully and follow their passion and follow their dream and support them in living a meaningful and purposeful life. But when the kids grow up and leave the house and everybody has gone on their way and everybody's engaged in their life, whatever that is, and they come back together, like at Christmas time right now, my children are coming home and we're just so delighting in being in each other's presence and seeing each other face to face and so happy to catch up with each other and find out what are you doing, what's going on in your life right now, who are you meeting, what are you studying, what are you learning, what are your plans, and it's a celebration of individuality. They don't all have to be like me or like my husband. They have to be who they are and just know that when they come to this place, they will be celebrated and supported as long as, you know, what they're doing is healthy and positive and progressive and not destructive. I imagine that, you know, if they were doing something destructive to themselves or others, then a loving family would try to help them get through that and make a different choice or go a different way. But and that, to me, is like the difference between a healthy socialization of religion where, you know, it's like, wow, what are you discovering about? And when Crystal and I have both been at the Parliament of the World's Religions, and in a way it's like that. It's like that for all the world. People are just as interested in what's going on with you and your religion as they are their own religion. They're very secure in their own place, and so they're very interested in your place and what do you know about God? What do you bring to the table in this regard? And that seems like it's a much healthier place to be in a religious sense than to be in this place where oftentimes religions get into this institutionalized place where you have to think exactly like I do or you're way off base and you are not
right.
In the kingdom. Forget that. I'm in the kingdom,
but
you are not.
That's really interesting, Paula, because we were just sharing a little bit about that last night at our party,
mm-hmm.
about our experience at the Parliament, how that felt like the kingdom in the way that Jesus meant it, because it was all of these people who were believers, who people of faith, who were acknowledging the sovereignty of God.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminded me to look up this morning the in paper 134, a quote that says, "But the moment you lose sight of the spirit sovereignty of God the Father, some one religion will begin to assert its superiority over other religions. And then, instead of peace on earth and goodwill among men, there will start dissensions, recriminations, even religious wars, at least wars among religionists. Free will beings who regard themselves as equal, unless they mutually acknowledge themselves as subject to some super sovereignty, some authority over and above themselves, sooner or later are tempted to try out their ability to gain power and authority over other persons and groups. The concept of equality never brings peace, except in the mutual recognition of some over-controlling influence of super sovereignty. The Urmier religionists lived together in comparative peace and tranquility because they had fully surrendered all their notions of religious sovereignty. Spiritually, they all believed in a sovereign God. Socially, full and unchallengeable authority rested in their presiding head, Symbioten. They well knew what would happen to any teacher who assumed to lord it over his fellow teachers. There can be no lasting religious peace on Urantia until all religious groups freely surrender all their notions of divine favor, chosen people, and religious sovereignty. Only when God the Father becomes supreme will men become religious brothers and live together in religious peace on earth."
And what is a sovereign except a king, if not a king? So I think this kingdom idea is also tied up in this idea of sovereignty, that God alone is sovereign, and in a kingdom, the king is sovereign.
I think that's in our beliefs, yes. I don't know if that is on other worlds, though. A sovereign would be looked at in a different way, I think, in a more loving, personal fashion, because they've had the Father in their lives from the get-go,
mm-hmm.
where we haven't. You know, that's why we've mm-hmm. leaned towards powers of politics and kingdoms and kings, and people are searching for these other things because we have,
Jonathan,
I'm sorry, we're very, very right in their speaking of, we've got to work in all different types of fashions in so many different. There's churches that we can belong to and movements, and we can bring change in each one of those and center them more around a personality unification instead of being split apart by the common thought distortions or cognitive thinking distortions that people get into that isolates them from each other. And that's what Andre was speaking about. What do we do about this kingdom, or how do we spread this kingdom better? It's all throughout the living with or exemplifying the Father in our lives and speaking about the Father, unifying people's thoughts around that God is more than just God. He's more than anything we can possibly imagine, but he's also just a loving Father, and getting the Father in our speaking, in our walk, and in our talk with others. Jesus exemplified the Father in his life, and in almost not every sentence, but at least in every paragraph that he spoke in the Urantia book, the word Father came out of his mouth. So, you know, he must have been leading people even then more closely into the Father.
Well, and the book says, so long as we teach our children to pray our Father who is in heaven, a great deal rests on the shoulders of human fathers to live their lives so that the word Father becomes worthily enshrined in the hearts of their children. And this, I think, is just so key. And here's another obstacle then that we all face, because I'm sure that all of you guys have met somewhere along the line somebody who really balks at the term Father, because that word has not been worthily enshrined in their hearts. And so that's just something else we have to get over. I mean, as a race, we have to evolve, you know, and not disconnect fathers from children. Children have to be connected in that heart space with their fathers. And fathers have to be connected with their children. We have to do what we can as a civilization to make sure that happens, because it's very, very important that that word becomes worthily enshrined.
You know, one characteristic of Jesus that I was just thinking about in regard to all of this is his constant curiosity. And, you know, Paula, you alluded to this in a family dynamic, and I think it's a really important characteristic to remember and aspire to. You know, he was just so constantly curious about everyone he encountered, and in being both God and man, he thereby exemplified not only the curiosity that we can bring to our relationships with each other, but also God's fundamental curiosity about us and to know us, you know, and in turn, you know, the boundless curiosity and capacity for it that we have toward our Creator parent. And I think it's something related to the idea of sovereignty, kingship, and also related to the idea of Father, as it's often understood now. There's something about that often has this kind of aura of like presuming to know it all and therefore not being curious, you know, like an authoritarian leader of any kind, like, oh, mm-hmm. I know best, or, you know, even Father, you know, Father knowing best, as if there's no room for curiosity in that. And in fact, I think it's the opposite. And that's something that it seems possible that something like organized religion could even contribute. And I specifically noticed this in my coursework this semester, because I took a class on Pentecostalism, and mm-hmm. Pentecostalism is growing at least as quickly as the trend of people abandoning organized religion. So those things are happening simultaneously. And so as part of my coursework, I went and attended a Pentecostal church, and, you know, I can't make generalizations about it just based on that one visit. One thing that I did notice and took note of was that very much of the service was about a sort of directed, participatory, and curious type of undertaking. The sermon took the examples of Esther and Deborah from the Bible and identified them as women who made an impact on their generation. And the question to the congregation was, how are you going to make an impact on your generation? You know, and in the Bible study, it was all about, you know, that line of you shall have no gods other than God. And, you know, what are the other things that become gods in our lives? And how are we each individually working to, you know, to overcome those and to focus our attention back on God the Father, and how do we support each other in that undertaking. And that was very directly opposed to experiences that I've had in other organized church settings, where the emphasis was almost exclusively on obedience, not only to God, but to the structure that was being imposed by the church. And I found that to be a very just notable distinction, and one that I could see happening on a larger scale as far as institutions that are actually there to foster religious curiosity, you know, among the individuals, as opposed to making mandates. So that was just something that struck me and perhaps could be useful.
Wow, that's really exciting.
Yeah, we have a question on the board, too, for Angie. Dajo on the board asks, Angie, I would think that Harvard still would be a bastion of liberal social action theology, liberation theology. Is this true today? And if so, how do you deal with it? That's a loaded question.
Yeah.
Yeah, knowing everything there is to know about Harvard Divinity School by being there for one semester now.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I can only speak to, you know, the experience I've had of it so far. It does seem like there's certainly a great deal of rhetoric about, you know, social justice, at least, liberation theology to an extent, or in certain areas more than others. But yeah, I mean, Harvard, I think the Divinity School kind of prides itself on, you know, a legacy of religiously based social action. And I am in a class with some people who are expressing dissatisfaction with the lack of that at the moment, that they feel like there's a lot of talk about it and talk about, you know, making big changes and disrupting negative social systems or systems of oppression, you know, but that they don't feel enough action is actually being taken, that it's a lot of talk and, you know, but still latent in all of that conversation is the idea that such action would be good, you know, and that religion should be the foundation for such action.
So religion is looked at to be something that should be in the social arena and not strictly in a spiritual standpoint. Go ahead.
Exactly. And specifically, Harvard has a legacy of Unitarianism being kind of, it's a bastion for Unitarianism, Unitarian Universalism at this point. And that, yes, certainly marries the institution of religion with the institution of social action.
Social,
you know, I look for
change,
the signs of the spiritual springtime. And I think that's one of them, actually. And we've had Phyllis Tickle on the show, and she's great. She talks about the Great Emergence, and she talks about how it's happening in all religions all over the planet right now, and how it happens periodically. I think she says every 500 years there's a Great Emergence, and it's like another level of opening up. And one of the things that the emergent Christians are talking about, and there are young people like you and John, you know, in their 20s and 30s, and they're asking the questions. And one of the issues for them is social justice. And I just think that's a part of evolution. You know, there was a time in our history when nobody cared whether social justice happened or not.
Mm-hmm.
There was hardly any social justice. You know, women were considered second-class citizens and still are largely in most of the world. So that's an issue of social justice. And I think even Jesus went a long way to correct that. And I just see that as evolution, and especially when whole groups of young people are holding that up and saying, you know, we need social justice. And maybe it's not in the realm of spirituality. And as Andre pointed out last week, you know, the great concept of seek first the kingdom of God and all things needful will be added, what Jesus said. You can't seek first what you need and then expect that God and the kingdom will be added. But if you seek God and the kingdom, all things needful will be added. So it's things in their right order. But I think that's an outworking of it, this desire to liberate. And often Jesus spoke many, many times about the liberated sons of God. He said, I've come to set the spiritual captives free. You know, so you don't necessarily be a spiritual captive in the kingdom of heaven. And that's what he was talking about.
I think we're getting into dangerous water here.
exactly.
We're getting into dangerous water.
Yeah.
Well, maybe
we should remember, to be spiritually liberated means that you could physically be in prison, as John the Baptist was, and unjustly beheaded, and yet he was a free, a liberated son of God. And Jesus himself didn't orient his mission to, social justice problems. In fact, when I guess Thomas was asking, when are we going to see the fullness of this kingdom coming in physical form, kind of is what he was asking. And this is what Jesus says, my children, I implore that you cease to apply the teaching of the kingdom of the Spirit to the sordid affairs of slavery, poverty, houses, and lands, and to the material problems of human equity and justice. These temporal matters are the concern of the men of this world. And, and then he goes on to say, and while in a way they affect all men, you have been called to represent me in the world, even as I represent my Father. So my feeling is with you that the social justice action, whatever, like they feel good. And I guess I'm not really clear in my mind how that stacks up with these kind of hardcore statements that Jesus says, sort of divorcing his teachings from directly being related to, the mission of social justice, dealing with sordid affairs of slavery and poverty.
Jonathan. I've always been uncomfortable about the marriage of this, within a church setting and within a spiritual community, because it seemed to me that was the direction that the apostles were constantly clamoring for him to go, as were the multitudes, and he consistently refused to do that. And he might have shown by his treatment of women, his treatment of Samaritans, his treatment of those who were considered lesser, that they were equals in the eyes of God, that we were all children of God. He also consistently said, that this work was not supposed to be political. And these kinds of movements, while they have very valid places in society, need, in my mind, to be separated from that spiritual community, because I don't know what kind of social community you may be involved in, but I've never been in one where people all agree on what those kinds of priorities should be. And I don't think that we ever will. And whenever we try to be uniform in that thinking, we fail. But we can be unity-minded when we look beyond those conditions and really focus on our spiritual unity.
And
go ahead.
No, go ahead, Crystal.
Well, obviously, I feel passionately about this, and I think that it's one of the ways in which I see religion derailing, in that it becomes so much about the kind of discouraging aspects of the world instead of the uplifting and positive understanding that, you know, the kingdom of heaven rules in the kingdoms of men.
Well, it's supposed to be a spiritual brotherhood of believers, not a social organization for change, not a university, not a sanitary or health organization. They've pandered into other areas, and that's what the Urantia book even talks about, is how Christianity became so much of a social movement. And when you're in a church and you're learning about what God is and what the Father is and who Jesus was, and then you turn around and put your South Baptist Church T-shirt on your back, and you go down and slap sandbags down at the rivers that are flooding your neighbors, now you just changed and took that spiritual setting and turned it into a social organization.
Well, let me interject
this. You step all the way out.
I think that I see the religious teachings as the leaven in the dough. And so, you know, seek first the kingdom of heaven. That's the leaven. That's what's going to create those groups who will be motivated to go out and do good things in the name of God. And I agree with you that church or the religious place where you're seeking that pure essence, that leaven that's going to change people's lives, that happens on that level, and it has to be pure and it has to be just, you know, spiritual. But then it's what changes people. And here's a paragraph that I've been wanting to share during this show, because we've touched on this several times, the difference between socialized religion and institutionalized. And I will underscore the fact that they don't say organized. They say socialized. So the socialization of religion versus the institutionalization of religion. This is what they say. This is from paper 99. There is a real purpose in the socialization of religion. It is the purpose of group religious activities to dramatize the loyalties of religion, to magnify the lures of truth, beauty, and goodness, to foster the attractions of supreme values, to enhance the service of unselfish fellowship, to glorify the potentials of family life, to promote religious education, to provide wise counsel and spiritual guidance, and to encourage group wisdom or group worship. And all live religions encourage human friendship, conserve morality, promote neighborhood welfare, and facilitate the spread of the essential gospel of their respective messages of eternal salvation. Now, in distinction, but as religion becomes institutionalized, its power for good is curtailed, while the possibilities for evil are greatly multiplied. The dangers of formalized religion are fixation of beliefs and crystallization of sentiments, accumulation of vested interests with increase of secularization, tendency to standardize and fossilize truth, diversion of religion from the service of God to the service of the church, inclination of leaders to become administrators instead of ministers, tendency to form sects and competitive divisions, establishment of oppressive ecclesiastical authority, creation of the aristocratic chosen people attitude, fostering of false and exaggerated ideas of sacredness, the routinizing of religion and the petrification of worship, tendency to venerate the past while ignoring present demands, failure to make up-to-date interpretations of religion, entanglement with functions of secular institutions. It creates the evil discrimination of religious caste. It becomes an intolerant judge of orthodoxy. It fails to hold the interest of adventurous youth and gradually loses the saving message of the gospel of eternal salvation. So To me, that's just such a great distinction between what we could do. It's like the difference between a healthy family and a dysfunctional family.
Can you think of an example of socialized religion?
Well, you know, it's once again, it's hard to give an example of that, but I think that, well, for me, study group is a great example of socialized religion.
Yeah.
And I experience it every Tuesday night at Mo and Jennifer's house, where we come together and we explore the truth together. And we facilitate each other's learning and discovery of God. And we, you know, I think we do capture a lot of those good and positive things. And it's not an institution, you know. Clearly, I mean, we come together with something in common. We all love this book, and we want to know more about it. We want to understand it better. But we socialize
around that. Or any prayer
group
that comes together.
Huh? Mm-hmm.
Even just a prayer group that comes together.
Of course,
you know, that's
the
socialization of it.
Absolutely.
I'm also thinking of, you know, what we've all been through in the last week or so with the death of Nelson Mandela, and being reminded of his life and the way he lived it, and the way he socialized his religion was very anti-ecclesiastical, and yet it was very powerful in the socialization experience. He was a great example of someone who was a prisoner, who was experiencing his own personal spiritual liberty throughout that entire process. He had a mission, which was a social, a political, and a social mission. But his personal religious experience and his socialized religion was spent with his fellow inmates who prayed and studied and learned together. And part of the process of their learning was how not to hate their oppressors.
Yeah, well.
Yeah.
Well, here's a good chance for a station identification. You're listening to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. We're talking about what is meant by the Kingdom of Heaven. Having a great conversation here, and I'd like to put on another caller, if you guys don't mind. This person has been holding for a while.
Sure.
Welcome, Mary.
Area code 514, you're with us on the Cosmic Citizen.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, Diane.
Well, hi, Diane.
I thought it was you.
Hi, Diane. Hi, Andre.
Calling from Montreal. Yes,
hello.
Diane
from Montreal.
From minus 20 and minus 30, let's put it that way.
Ooh,
yeah.
Wow.
Mm. Well, welcome to some warmth of fellowship.
You took the words out of my mouth. It is so beautiful to listen to all of you. I just felt this call to connect and call, because what all of you have been saying is just so superb, and it is so opposite of what certain people in certain countries are living, and this beautiful thing. And if it's okay, I would like to share something, because like Angie, you said some incredible words, and then there's another person, Jonathan, who said things, and these clues all came together, and it made me think of when it was said earlier that Jesus told us, you have been called to represent me, so he could not be clearer than that. Mm-hmm. And when he said that, to represent me, then I thought in my mind, he also said, 6 times it's mentioned in the part 4 of the Urantia book, he who has seen me has seen the Father. So right there and then, we have the direct connection between him and the Father in heaven. And then in paper 196, there's a sentence that stuck with me for quite a few years, and it really, really sums it all up to me when that sentence says, it's in paper 196 about the second last page at the bottom right corner, and it says, God, because you've all been talking about personality, and it says, God is the personality of love. And when I read that, I thought of Jesus saying, you have been called to represent me, and he who has seen me has seen the Father. So there he was, and there he is still today, representing that. So God is the personality of love, and we know we all have a unique personality. And then it continues by saying, from whom all of the universe manifestations of truth, beauty, and goodness are derived. And so it all came clear to me that it is so simple. God is that personality of love. Look at Jesus. He's the example of the Father. He who has seen him has seen the Father. He's the personality of love from whom all of the universe manifestations, not just on planet Urantia, but around the world, the universe manifestations of truth, beauty, and goodness are derived. So this is the model for us. We are the personality of love. We are his extension. To me, Jesus came to found this new religion of love, and he was the nucleus, and we are the aftermath, the effect that continued, the sons and daughters of God who are the personality of love. That from us, all of the, at least Urantia, manifestations of truth, beauty, and goodness can be derived. So we're back to what a lot of people are saying around the world. It all starts with us individually. And when we think of religion of love, religion means religare, to link again. So that means with simply expressing love and living love in its manifestations of truth, beauty, and goodness, we are connecting directly with the Father, and we spread around the world. And I just wanted to share this because you all said it together, and it was like, hallelujah, this is just so beautiful.
Well, and many times Jesus said the kingdom of God is in the hearts of men.
Yes.
And when you think of heart, then you think of love. So what he's saying is the kingdom of God is manifested in the love of men.
It's the kingdom
and
of love.
And women, obviously.
Yes.
The kingdom of love.
The kingdom
where
love
of love. Where love reigns supreme.
Yes.
And, of course, the Father is the head of that.
It
and
is so Kristen simple.
Wants me to tell you guys her phone died, and so she had to drop off. But there was a few things that last night her brother and her dad pointed out in the three concepts of the kingdom. She can't remember the third one, but she said one was faith in the fatherhood of God. Another was willingness to do the will of the Father in heaven. And she wonders, Andre, do you know the third? What's the third one?
You're going to put me on the spot like that right now?
Yeah. Sorry, my friend.
For me, I mean, it really does come down to this doing of the will of God, you know, being an exhibition of creature willingness to share the inner life with God. That's such an important aspect of all of this. And when you were talking about the socialization of religion, it brought to mind the 15 years experience that I had with the Living the Teachings group that we had in the Boulder area, started by Larry and Joan Mullins, literally back in November of 1996, and that we carried on and met on a weekly basis to literally share what our walk was like for that week. It could be, it wasn't sharing, you know, how good we were. it was sharing, you know, what kinds of things did we encounter in the week that affected us, whether they were in the material realm, whatever, but were affecting our inner life. So in sharing that inner life with each other, in one respect, we were doing the will of God, because one of the things that we don't really get to do in the socialization of our religion, in my experience, is we don't get to see that the inside of other people match the insides of us. Very often what we're doing is we're matching the insides of ourselves with the outsides of other people. And that's a tremendously... Exactly. And that's a tremendously isolating kind of an experience. And the benefit of getting to see where people are actually living and that they're struggling with a lot of the same kinds of things. They're struggling with their mortgages. They're struggling with their marriages. They're struggling with their children. All of those kinds of things that people are going through, when that is shared and you're going through that too, you have the opportunity to begin to say, well, these people really are my brothers and sisters. We really are on a plane of equality with each other. We're going through the same things. And we're also going to God with these same problems. That was the added emphasis of this group, is that we weren't just sharing and kvetching about problems. We were also sharing in the context that we chose to bring God into it, and we were trying to bring these problems to God and see what could happen with it. And you know, prayer was part of the group, sharing group prayer and individual silent meditation together. All of that was part of it. That is a tremendous experience, and if people are looking for ways to socialize their religion, that is a very, very powerful way to do so, and I highly recommend it. I know that I or Larry Mullins would be happy to help anybody in setting up that kind of a group by giving some of just the key principles in getting that kind of a group going. The only thing it requires is the commitment of people to want to do that kind of thing. And I agree with the other comments. You know, when a prayer group gets together, I've been part of centering prayer groups that get together once a week just to be in silence together and to study some teaching around centering prayer. All of that contributes to the inner life. And I used to look at it as, you know, there's a fence requires posts, you know, to hold it up. And the fence posts in my practice were the weekly meetings that I got to that... Mm.
Are you there, Andre? Andre?
We lost another fence post.
That's the third week in a row.
Yeah.
Oh. Where someone was right at the apex of their point and then they dropped off. It's happened three times in a row now.
Crystalline is back on.
Yeah, Crystalline's back. Oh. Hi, Crystalline. Yeah, we lost Andre right at the apex of his story about the defense posts and how the posts hold up.
But you know what, Andre? What Andre was saying was so true.
He's done.
Yeah.
Hold on just a second. Andre, you bumped off the air. He's going to try.
So Andre and Crystalin are also in the same house, you guys, and just like Jonathan and Angie. So.
Ah.
But what Andre was saying was so true, because when he said that when people communicate together and that's the act of being humble enough to open to everyone, that's being in the mode of love. And when we are in that mode of love, we can hear what the other one is saying. It's something
right.
We understand. It's just not noise coming through our ears, but it reaches the heart, the nucleus of the person, and we can say, yes, I sympathize, I understand. We can offer suggestion, help, even if it's just a good listening ear. And that, to me, is the kingdom of brothers and sisters of love. And in love, we seem to minimize problems. We seem to maximize solutions. You know, so what he was saying was
love is like Angie was saying earlier, you know, it reminded me of something that Jennifer likes to say, that person was interesting and interested. And love is interested. love is interested in you, what you're doing. You use the term curious, but it's the same thing. I'm interested in you. I want to know you. I want to hear your heart. I want to share an experience with you. You know, it's an attitude. Love is an attitude.
That's part of the desire to do good to others.
Right, part of the desire to do good.
Once again, we're down to the last 5 minutes.
Well, Audrey, you want to... Just when we started...
Did you bring me back on?
Yeah, you're
just
on.
Just by.
Oh, I'm back on, okay. Well, I felt like maybe the angels were thinking I was talking too long. No, I'm just kidding. They don't do that kind of stuff. But I really appreciate, you know, in our last 5 minutes, I just want to say I really appreciate Angie and Jonathan and Aaron and Diane, all of your comments. And of course, to my co-hosts, this has been a really fruitful discussion. And I think, as Angie was saying, you know, it is an open question. You know, how do we bring about this realization of the kingdom of heaven as a family of God? There are these little ways that we might try and do that. And if we're willing to do it with each other, and I think for one thing, you know, Cosmic Citizen is at least a step in that direction. I love the community that we get to have for 2 hours where we get to you know, virtually be together and share some of these ideas. It bolsters me for the rest of my week. It's one of the ways in which my spiritual life is bolstered, because I know there are other people that are not only thinking the way I am, but I know they're turning to God inwardly the way I am and aspire to more and more.
Beautiful.
Exactly.
Well, and Crystalline has the 3 points that her brother and dad, we had such a great conversation last night with Crystalline's brother, David, and her dad, Rick, and she has those 3 points of the kingdom for us. So what are they, Crystalline?
Yeah, David was mentioning that they were talking about this in their kids' study group last week, or just a few days ago, but it was about what were the three keys, what were the three key elements to the kingdom, because your answer was mentioned all over the place, all sorts of different aspects of what Jesus meant by the kingdom. But they said it first is the recognition of the sovereignty of God. Second is the understanding that we are all children of that same God. And the third was the efficacy, the understanding of the efficacy of the doing of the will of the Father in one's life.
Mm. And it's that third one that's real key, isn't it? That's the second mile faith step.
Knowing that when you make that effort to try to do the will of the Father, that the outcome will be the best for all concerned.
Well, and that's what infects the rest of the human emotion stream with the benign virus of love that we need to be doing every day in that walk.
There you go. Well, I want to say to all of you, my friends, I hope and pray you have a wonderful holiday season, and I will hold you in my heart, being together, being loving towards each other, and love with each other, and I'll hold that vision of a very blessed and happy holiday for all of you and all of our listeners. And I thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a great series of 3 shows and really enjoyed doing it for our master. Contemplating him is one of the best things anybody can do, I think. So wishing you all such a beautiful, blessed holiday season and a fabulous, healthy, and prosperous 2014.
Can I say a little something?
Of course.
I just would like to say thank you to all of you, because I'm saying this from a listener's point of view. I've been on the listening end, and I want to say thank you from all of us, the listeners, to all of you, the animators, because we could feel your love throughout the waves, the radio waves, And it is so beautiful that you need to hear it. Because, you know, as they say, the act is of man, the consequences are God's. And so sometimes we don't know how far that will go. And because of the beauty of the Internet being planetary, I need to say thank you, because it was resounding. This is why I called, because I felt so called to say thank you. So I just wanted to say this from the listener's point of view. You reach your point. Mission accomplished.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Diane.
Well, it's the truth. It's the truth. Yeah.
Ditto. All good
well,
things.
Merry Christmas to all.
And
Merry
thank
Christmas,
you all
Merry Christmas to everyone.
And I invite you guys to call back anytime. We always love having you. Loved your comments. Jonathan, Angie, you're awesome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Goodbye until next week.
Yeah.
God bless.
Till next time.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.